And now on Counterpoint, we continue our look at the Middle Ages and why it matters. Last week, we discussed what we could learn from crime and punishment 1,000 years ago. Today, we look at what the Middle Ages has to say about women and the fabrication of tradition.
Our guest is Felice Lifschitz, professor from the Women's Studies program at the University of Alberta. In a moment, she tells us how women are really depicted in Dan Brown's wildly popular book, The Da Vinci Code. But first up, just why does she think history matters?
Whether we like it or not, people act in the present on the basis of what happened in the past. And I don't mean something just simplistic like the Santiago quote that everybody always says, you know, if you don't know the past, you're condemned to repeat it. People in their own lives, when they think back on their own histories, they decide what to do based on what they think has already happened, what have been the causes that have gone into a particular problem and how to solve it. So people do act on the basis of what they think happened in the past. And so I think historians in general, and by that I would include anyone who talks about the past in any way. You can also be an art historian, or you can be a music historian, literary historian, etc., bear an enormous social responsibility for creating the conditions within which people think about how they should act. And I've always been concerned to think very carefully myself about what I say to my students. For instance, do I just unthinkingly cheerlead when I describe past expansions and conquests? Because we tend to fall into that somehow, without questioning, you know, whether that's good or not. Or one of the specific examples that is more peculiar to the Middle Ages that we bring up in the introduction is the question of the entire discourse of the fall of Rome, right? And then you get the Middle Ages, or especially the early Middle Ages, as a period that is generally coded as negative and barbaric in both learned and popular discourse. And some of the features of the transformation of the Roman world, which is the way many specialists talk about nowadays, not necessarily the fall of Rome, but the transformation, is a movement, for instance, from more larger scale industrial level production that created enormous amounts of waste that was a feature of an empire that spanned so many miles, a move away from that to more localized production, to more small-scale production, to less waste, that actually could be, if we wanted to support environmentalism in the present, if we wanted to support some things that we think right now might be a good way forward, we should really be making sure that when we talk about that period in the past, that we don't speak negatively about that move, that we actually celebrate it, or at least can suggest some ways in which it was a positive thing and could provide a model. So there are some ways where it's not only about the alterity of the Middle Ages. There are some ways that we can talk about things that happened in the European Middle Ages, which tends to be seen as a time period of little relevance to modern or contemporary concerns, and we can find things that are positive and could be useful there.
Do you think the societies such as yours and mine are still as attentive to history as we used to be? I mean, is it still as enthusiastically and widely studied and talked about, do you think, in the public arena?
I think it very much is, and perhaps more than it used to be, because of popular culture media that make it so much more possible through television, through movies, through video games, to put yourself back in time, even if you can't even read. I mean, even if you don't take any advanced courses, even if you don't even graduate from high school, let alone, you know, go to college, people have tremendous exposure nowadays to what happened in the ancient Roman Empire with Egyptian pyramids. Yeah, I think that, with the Second World War, I mean, there is just an enormous appetite for a sense of knowing, you know, where we come from somehow and what our stories are. A lot of the stories people seem to find just inherently interesting, and other things help explain where they're coming from. But the way things are presented by professional historians are not always what people are in the market for. And then also perhaps sometimes the way history is taught in secondary schools or elementary schools is not particularly conducive. It makes people think they don't like history because it is just given as memorization of facts and names and dates, and they think, oh, I really don't like history, I'm not interested. But then they realize that the tourism to sites of historical significance is enormous. For instance, they really want to go to places where something big happened and read the historical markers. So there is a tremendous, I think there's an enormous appetite for history. People are very interested in it.
Felice, your chapter on women is called The Da Vinci Code and the Fabrication of Tradition. Now, many reviewers found the novel a stirring, almost feminist work, with its revelations such as that the medieval church burned no fewer than 5 million witches at the stake. Is it really a feminist book?
Well, I argue that it is not at all a feminist book, and that it participates in one of the most anti-feminist ways of thinking about the past that I can think of, which is to present the past as, and especially the European Middle Ages, this long, long period of many centuries, as a time when no one could value women at all except maybe a couple of very few, you know, brave free thinkers, and most people just, you know, despised them, and women completely accepted that, and, you know, no women had any voice or authority or position.
And it stacks the argument, doesn't it, such as that figure I just quoted in my question.
Yes,
it does. And what was the real figure?
The real figure is closer to 50,000, but the thing is,
a big difference, a few
there are two things, right? That one is that the period during which many, many witches were burned is not really the Middle Ages. It's the early modern period. It's a later period. And there were many men who were burned as witches, you know, as well. And many, many other things went into that particular development as well. But everything that's bad, this is the sort of image of the Middle Ages in general as it's a very anti-Catholic or anti-religious image of the Middle Ages as the time when no one could think for themselves and everything was really horrible. And sometimes just people push everything into the Middle Ages, whether it actually happened in the so-called Middle Ages or not. So, for instance, if you can go to pop culture sites, like in Orlando, Florida, there's one of a chain of dinner show restaurants called, you know, Medieval Times, where there's a joust. Mm. And next to the one in Orlando is a place called Medieval Life, where they recreate, they say, an authentic medieval village of around the year 1000. And one of the things they have to have in this authentic medieval village that everybody knows no place was ever without in the Middle Ages was a torture chamber. Mm. And you can pay an extra dollar to get into the torture chamber, and there you can see all the horrific implements of torture that the aristocracy in the Middle Ages used to completely oppress their peasantry and make it impossible for anyone to think or say anything. And the objects that are there are, of course, reproductions, but they're all reproductions of 18th century things. And the images that are there to show you what these medieval implements of torture would have been like were all taken from the Empress Maria Theresa's Enlightenment-era encyclopedia of torture, right? Because one of the things the Enlightenment rulers were trying to do was to rationalize the way you judicially punish and you find information, right? So there's all sorts of things out there like that, right? Witches burnt, you know, torture, but people somehow associate them all, in many cases falsely, with the Middle Ages, right? The Dark Ages, and create this horrific period that you can't imagine anything worse than that, and, for many reasons.
In the book, Mary Magdalene becomes an object of worship almost equal to Jesus himself. I mean, isn't that a feminist move on Dan Brown's part?
No, because of the way she is so absolutely passive. She never really does anything. She never says anything. I suppose that if the medieval reality of how people thought about Mary Magdalene were, in fact, that no one ever talked about her and no one ever thought about her at all. And if they ever dared to mention her, they would just say that she was a horrible prostitute and an example of a morally corrupt woman who just showed how corrupt women all are. I mean, if that were the reality, then for Dan Brown to suggest that perhaps some people venerated Mary Magdalene would be a feminist move. But the fact is, the medieval reality was quite different from that, and Mary Magdalene was already widely venerated all over Europe as one of the most important saints that anyone could think of. And she was venerated for doing all sorts of things that were far more active and exemplary and provided better role models, if I could, you know, say so, than just happening to be, apparently, according to Brown, she's somehow of royal stock and represented the divine feminine. So men could worship her, and Jesus married her, and they had a baby together. But she was in her medieval biographies, in her medieval Latin biographies, of which there were many copies in different monastic libraries or cathedral libraries, and extracts from which were read on her saints' days when people had on the feasts of Mary Magdalene. In all of those stories, people talked about how she was the apostle to the apostles, the first, you know, person to whom Jesus appeared, and that she would, because she was so special and she was told to go preach to other people. And then in the characteristic medieval way of embroidering on anything that was not explicitly contradicted by scripture, people went on to explain all the things that happened to Mary Magdalene after the crucifixion, about how she went to southern France and she became a missionary there, and she was a very powerful preacher who persuaded people to become Christians. So she becomes an important, visible, vocal, public woman who led communities and who worked miracles. And people were completely comfortable with this notion of a holy woman who spoke and preached and worked miracles.
Very different from the character in Dan Brown's book. And Sophie Naveau, the novel's contemporary heroine, also strikes me as not quite the feminist ideal. And yet, despite that, I mean, the novel has appealed to many women, including many I know who'd regard themselves as feminists. What do you think's going on there? How does Dan Brown achieve this effect?
Well, I think partly it's because of how people are so generally ignorant of medieval realities, right? And they do just assume that things were so horrible that it completely makes sense to see women spoken about and praised at all. If you have the majority view of the Middle Ages, then I think that you will be really thrilled to discover that there might be other ways of thinking about Mary Magdalene. Part of it is not everyone sits down to analyze popular culture products in enormous detail. The only reason I did is because the Miami Herald asked to interview me about the Da Vinci Code because it was a phenomenon. I hadn't read it at all, but because I was going to be interviewed, I had to sit down and read it really carefully and try to analyze it. And that's when I noticed that Dan Brown's main character, the male hero, is the one who explains everything, even though Sophie Naveau is described as very smart and she's described as very beautiful and she cracks codes and things. But then I noticed that every conversation, he explained everything to her, even her own life, and she just went, oh, really? Wow, oh my God, you know, just asked questions, right? I only noticed it because I sat down to analyze it, right? So, you know, most people will just kind of come away with a superficial impression of things, myself included, if I just go to a movie or I just read a book for entertainment, and I see she's, you know, she's capable. She does many capable things. She saves Langdon. She saved Langdon's life, you know, at the beginning. So she has many, many attributes, but it's the deeper analysis that some people will sit down to do that reveal that the surface plot is not all that's going on there.
Right. Felice, it must have been quite an experience for you to sort of suddenly realize that your own subject area had been kidnapped and turned into a completely different sort of creature. But we have to leave it there. Yeah, I'm afraid we must leave it there. But thanks very much for your time. You've been telling us some very intriguing things. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Professor Felice Lifshitz from the University of Alberta. She's co-editor of the book Why the Middle Ages Matter, and her chapter there is titled Women, the Da Vinci Code and the Fabrication of Tradition. We'll have a link on the Counterpoint website, which you'll find at abc.net.au/rn/counterpoint. And next week, in the final instalment in our Middle Ages trilogy, Diane Elliott examines sex scandals and the clergy.
I can't wait. But that's it for us this week. The program is produced by Ian Coombe. Our sound engineer is John Magic Fingers Diamond. I'm Paul Comrie Thompson. Uru.
And I'm Michael Duffy. Bye for now.